Picture opening your front door to find your neighbor collapsed on their porch, dead for 3 days in sweltering heat, and realizing you never even knew their name. This wasn't a hypothetical tragedy. During Chicago's 1995 heatwave, 739 people died, most of them alone in their apartments while neighbors went about their lives just feet away. The coroners who investigated discovered something chilling. The victims didn't die from lack of air conditioning. They died from lack of connection. In neighborhoods where people knew each other, residents survived because someone checked on them. In isolated neighborhoods, people perished in silence. This pattern reveals a truth we'd rather not face. Loneliness is killing us, literally. Your body treats a lonely day like smoking an entire pack of cigarettes. Chronic isolation increases your risk of premature death by 25%, more than obesity, more than heavy drinking. Yet we've built a society that manufactures loneliness at industrial scale. A fifth of Americans now cite loneliness as a major source of unhappiness. Among those over 45, a third struggle with what researchers call chronic loneliness. And these numbers likely understate the crisis, because we've become so uncomfortable with the word lonely that we call it depression instead. A clinical diagnosis feels less shameful than admitting we're simply alone. Over the past 50 years, America has split into two countries sharing the same geography. Researchers call them scissors graphs, the top third thriving while the bottom two-thirds decline across every metric: out-of-wedlock births, fatherlessness, obesity, financial security, neighborhood trust. Family formation reveals the divide starkly. Among women without college degrees, out-of-wedlock births jumped from 20% in the 1970s to nearly 70% today. Among college-educated women, under 10%. Nuclear families remain standard in wealthy suburbs, while single parenthood dominates working-class neighborhoods. Education drives the split. Only one-third of Americans have college degrees, yet they've captured 80% of recent economic gains. College-educated parents practice concerted cultivation, reading more to children, driving them to enrichment activities, building networks of mentors. Their children inherit not just wealth, but connections and pathways to success. Working-class children face precarious lives with thin social connections. The two groups rarely intermarry or share neighborhoods. Movement between these worlds has become vanishingly rare. Work once provided identity, community, and purpose. Your grandfather wasn't just employed, he was Coach Smith or Farmer Jones. Work, faith, family, and recreation intertwined, creating natural tribes rooted in place. That world has vanished. Workers now stay at companies just 4 years, down from 25 years in the 1970s. Work has shifted from a noun, an identity, to a verb, something we do temporarily. The disruption is accelerating. Driving, America's most common occupation, could see two-thirds of positions eliminated by autonomous vehicles within a decade. McKinsey predicts that within 12 years, up to one-third of American workers, 800 million globally, will face fundamental job disruption. Some experts predict half of American workers will soon be freelancers, cobbling together temporary projects. When work no longer provides stable identity or community, who are we? We need to be needed, not just for income, but for purpose. Without it, we're left grasping for identity in increasingly desperate places. As authentic community collapses, TV personalities become surrogate family. News sets mimic living rooms, creating false belonging while selling comfort instead of information. Sean Hannity earns $40 million annually orchestrating rage. His formula, liberals are evil, you're a victim, be furious, tells isolated people exactly what they want to hear. Most cable news and talk radio operate this way, keeping fears and hatreds neatly aligned. Media has perfected the outrage business model. The Washington Post's Bandito tool tests headlines in real time, keeping whichever attracts more clicks. Headlines now tell us how to feel, not just report events. A cable producer confirmed, "We only do stories that make people who love us more, and those that make people who hate us more." In 1951, I Love Lucy drew 70% of Americans. Today, top shows like Hannity and Maddow capture barely 1%. We've fragmented into isolated bubbles where every extremism finds validation, and media profits from our loneliest, angriest impulses. Steve Jobs revolutionized personal technology, yet strictly limited his children's device use. Silicon Valley's elite recognize the addictive power of their creations and shield their families accordingly. Meanwhile, the rest of us scroll into oblivion. The statistics are damning. 26% of Americans are almost constantly online, rising to 40% among 18 to 29-year-olds. We check smartphones every 4.3 minutes, losing our ability to read closely and focus deeply. We seek validation from digital friends rather than real ones, becoming lonelier despite constant connection. Since the iPhone's 2007 introduction, real sexual activity has declined while pornography consumption has skyrocketed. Nearly half of 18 to 39-year-olds admit to viewing porn yesterday. Smartphones emit blue light that signals our brains to wake up, disrupting sleep patterns. The solution isn't rejecting technology, but establishing boundaries. Set limits. Create phone-free zones. Reclaim your attention from algorithms designed to capture it. At Lincoln's People City Mission, the homeless celebrated their new cemetery with profound relief. Their greatest fear wasn't homeless in life, but being forgotten in death. The memorial garden promises, "You are not forgotten." This contrasts with modern American life. We've become what researcher Richard Florida calls the mobile, gliding from place to place, never quite landing. We're always anticipating what's next, preventing contentment, which isn't about getting what you want, but giving thanks for what you've been given. Real joy comes not from endless choices, but from deep connections, flesh and blood friends who stand by you through suffering. Many never invest in their communities because they're always planning their exit. But there's wisdom in the quote attributed to Luther. "If I believed the world were to end tomorrow, I would still plant a tree today." Community is hard everywhere. People everywhere are annoying. Commit anyway. Act as if your body will end up where you are. Buy a cemetery plot. Eventually, you'll be right. Political tribalism is a symptom of collapsing social bonds. Loneliness channels our need for belonging into artificial hatred, making us obsess over trivial differences while ignoring profound commonalities. The solution isn't in Washington. Our identity cannot be rooted in anti-tribes or politics, but in local communities. Redirect energy from angry national discourse to serving your immediate surroundings. Volunteer at schools, help at soup kitchens, visit nursing homes, throw balls with children, bake cookies for new neighbors. These aren't quaint suggestions. They're the only path back to sanity. Turn off the screens. Engage face to face. When we prioritize political affiliations above being parents, spouses, neighbors, our connections fray. Politics has always evoked emotion, but people once discussed it and remained friends. What we lack isn't legislation, but love, the force that transforms them into we. It's whether you know your neighbor's name, whether anyone would notice if you didn't come home, whether you've planted roots deep enough that when crisis comes, someone will check on you. That's not politics, that's survival.